Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Scotland, Episode 4, Becoming Picts. I've been looking forward to this moment for some time. The chance to start on one of the more remarkable stories of history, the emergence and extraordinary disappearance of an entire culture and people, the Picts. Now, given the lack of evidence between the 2nd and the 9th centuries in particular, it's potentially a confusing time. So it might be a good place for a bit of big picture stuff, just to give you all a bit of a framework. Essentially, the very broad story everyone has focused on about, the next 6 centuries or so, is one of state formation and religion. So, that is to say, that 4 nations appear in one way or another in Scotland as the Romans disappear. There are the Picts in the north and east, the Gaels and the Kingdom of Dalriada in the west, the Britons of Strathclyde and Cumbria in the Clyde Basin and southwest, based at a place called Alt Clute, and then the Angles of Lothian and Northumbria in the southeast. These 4 then mix it up for a while. They adopt Christianity according to their own idioms. We then have a period of Viking invasion, of course, and then traditionally, along comes a Dalriadic man called Kenneth MacAlpine, who is described actually as King of the Picts. He died in 858, and before he died, he brought them all together into one kingdom, the Kingdom of Alba. Though now, of course, Kenneth's role is somewhat minimised in favour of a slightly later date, and a conscious attempt to form the Kingdom of Alba as a break from the past. Alba will become known as Scotland in the fullness of time when everyone's good and ready. In the process, Pictland and the Picts completely disappear, which is remarkable. That then is the path upon which we are now placing our feet. In what follows, at least, you will have a very broad framework to hold on to, the formation of different nations, the eventual combination of those kingdoms in the 9th century. The emergence of the Picts in this story is one associated with a deal of controversy. Scottish historians recently have been somewhat impatient of the way in which the texts and archaeology have been looked at in the past. They've challenged and reassessed the basic foundation story, which is derived from good old Gildas. This is the idea that the Scottish nation is constructed of peoples that came from over the sea, against the view now that actually we should be talking mainly about changes in culture rather than changes in ethnicity. Reassessing the history of the Picts is particularly difficult because of a rather romantic mythology which has got in the way of really understanding who they were. The word enigmatic is constantly attached to them, and it can be a bit of a blind. The subtext has been that here is an exceptional culture and civilization, exceptional in a European context, with unique characteristics. And always unhelpfully, they've maybe had bits of nationalistic fervour growing on their history like lichen. Now, nothing wrong with a bit of nationalistic fervour, as long as it doesn't obscure the light. Antiquarians of the 16th century spoke of the Picts mainly from classical sources. And then in the 18th century, interest blossomed, with travellers logging and cataloguing the surviving Pictish stones, which are surprisingly cool and which we'll come to. In the 1950s, the academic community really picked up that a focus was needed here and fueled much more archaeology, but still maybe with the unhelpful enigmatic thing going on. "Quite the darkest people of Dark Age Britain," was a quote from a historian in the 1960s. So, why so fascinating then? Well, there is the fact that, without wanting to annoy Scottish historians, they really are enigmatic, leaving tantalisingly rare glimpses of their culture, which are incredibly difficult to read and put together into a coherent narrative. At one stage, therefore, it was thought that the Picts, almost uniquely, traced the descent of their kings through the female line, matrilineal. Well, that's interesting. There was also at one stage a very popular theory that the Picts spoke a language which was non-Indo-European. And that's more than interesting, that falls into the wildly exciting category. Then there is their art. This survives mainly through the stones and symbols, some Christian, some not obviously so, clustered mainly in northeastern and eastern Scotland. These are also extraordinary. The consensus is that the symbols on them are a written language, which we are unable to decode. The symbols are often very geometric, combined with symbols and representations of animals, which are again most unusual, and I have to say, rather fascinating. There's a famous Pictish beast, something like a dolphin maybe, which is a great example. I've gathered some of those images up for you on the historyofengland.co.uk if you want to go and have a look. There's the initial emergence of the Picts. Here is what looked like a consolidated kingdom, Pictland, which had emerged, maybe from peoples from across the sea. There's even a tradition that maybe they'd come from northern Spain. Gildas here really helped to build this idea, this tradition. The lad really did have a way with words. Listen to this. And when the Romans went back home, there emerged from the coracles that had carried them across the sea valleys the foul hordes of Scots and Picts, like dark throngs of worms who wriggle out of narrow fissures in the rock when the sun is high and the weather grows warm. Now, don't tell me you don't feel slightly nauseous, as though you've just seen alien burst out of John Hurt's stomach. I mean, that's good writing, isn't it? The general consensus appears to be that it's rubbish history, but don't tell me that's not great writing. There is also the barbarism thing, the triumph of barbarism. Here are people who tore down the mighty civilization of Rome. And of course, you can characterize the Romans as the great civilizers or the great oppressors, as you see fit, according to your idiom. And then finally, you have their quite remarkable rubbing out, on their own. Seriously, Cnæd MacAlpine becomes king of the Picts. And with a generation, they're gone, as though they'd never been, replaced by Alba. They're a lost people, and we love lost people, don't we? We love mysteries. So all of this, together with the lack of documentary sources, has meant a flourishing of the more weird and wonderful theories to fill the gaps. The Picts became extraordinary exceptions, standing outside the normal development of culture in northern Britain and indeed in northern Europe. Over the last few decades, and particularly the last 20 years, there's been a merciless gathering and removal of bunk by Scottish historians. It's interesting to be so close to this. One of the books I used is by someone called Dr. Sally Foster, and it's called Picts, Gaels and Scots, Early Historic Scotland. She first wrote the book in 1996 and then updated in 2004 and 2014. In the introduction, she notes how much more she had had to change than she thought, based on the work of historians James Fraser and Alex Wolfe since 2009. Actually, she also reflects on why the Pict has become such an iconic figure in Scottish history. Here's what she says. We want to see the unique symbol-incised stones as non-Christian, as signals of resistance to an incoming ideology in much the same way as we like to think that those pesky Picts opposed the Romans. So, we'll explore all of this as we go. But it's worth starting off with a few things that have already been debunked so they don't mislead us. One of these is language. The idea that the Picts spoke a non-Indo-European language has been kicked firmly into the long grass. The debate is made harder, of course, by the fact that we don't have a single word of decoded Pictish available to us. But the consensus now is that the Picts were Britons, who spoke the Brittonic language, what we called P-Celtic last time, as opposed to the Q-Celtic of the Gaels. Alongside this, the Gildas Wiggly Worm theory that the Picts came from somewhere else, including a theory that they came from northern Spain, has also firmly had the bunk removed. Once again, the name of the game now is continuity. What we need to explain, therefore, is how Tacitus and Ptolemy's tribes, the Maiatai and the Caledonii, became the Picts. One more thing before we move away from the historiography thing. It's worth noting that none of the above means the Picts are any less fascinating or worthy of study. Seriously, check out the art, of which there's loads on the interweb. It's also been recognised that the contribution of the Gaels of Dalriada have been overemphasised in the story of the formation of Alba and Scotland over the years, to the detriment of the contribution of the Brittonic kingdom of Strathclyde, but mainly of Pictland. So none of this downplays the importance of the Picts, it just recognises the importance of ignoring the siren calls of exoticism and mysticism and placing the Picts firmly in their proper context of northern Britain. We left our story with the campaigns of Severus at the start of the 3rd century, a campaign that was quite remarkably successful in establishing peace on the northern frontier of the Roman province of Britannia. We described a world of northern British tribes which, broadly speaking, probably shared the characteristics of fully civil societies, or farmer republics, with the freedom from formal state structures that implies, but the tyranny of blood feud and regular violence and raiding it also implies. We described a world of varying relationships with Rome, Alta Brigantia, between Hadrian's Wall and the defunct Antonine Wall, where tribes, especially the Wotodini from Traparain Law, were probably enthusiastic Romanizers, feeding social elites and hierarchies. Inner Caledonia, where the Caledonians and Maiatai sought Roman goods and bribes, but with evidently less enthusiasm and frequency. And Atlantic Scotland, where survivals of Roman materials are pretty rare. Over the next 100 years, enormous changes would take place in these societies, in their structure, in the way they viewed themselves, and in the way they were viewed from outside. These changes would lead to an event that would shock the whole Roman world, expose the terminal decline of the Roman system in Britain, and subject Roman Britannia to a chilling and hideous forewarning of their future, the barbarian conspiracy of 367. Ptolemy had listed 10 tribes north of the Clyde Forth line in the 2nd century, and then Cassius Dio had spoken of just 2, as we discussed last time. There are 2 principal races of the Britons, the Caledonians and the Maiatai, and the names of the others have merged in these 2. The Maiatai live next to the cross wall which cuts the island in half, and the Caledonians are beyond them. And then in 297, we get a new lot. A panegyric was written of the Roman Emperor Constantius, who'd come to Britain to fight north of the wall in the early 4th century. Obviously, this being a panegyric, the author was bigging up his subject. So he decided to diss Julius Caesar and the Britons he had fought. So he described the Britons thus. A nation which was then half primitive, and accustomed to fight still only half naked, only with the Picts and the Irish. This then is our very first mention of the Picts in 297. A few years later, they're back, appearing in another panegyric, this time of Constantine, which contains this key phrase. The forests and marshes of the Caledonians and other Picts. So by Jiminy, what's going on here? In the middle of the 2nd century, we had a bunch of tribes. Then 50 or 60 years later, there are just 2 still standing, the Maiatai and the Caledonians. And then suddenly, there are these Picts. What's going on? Has there been a bloodbath north of the wall? Or a hideous process of political consolidation? Or, as Gildas suggested, a bunch of wormy coracles have wiped out all those other tribes? There is a foundation tradition for the Picts, which is recorded in a Gaelic poem called The Seven Children of Cruinia, which was probably written around 850 AD, Cruinia being the Gaelic name for Pict. The poem divides the Pictish nation into 7 regions, one for each of the sons. This is a well-trodden, time-honoured tradition for the creation of foundation myths, which is probably what this is, the retrospective allocation of founders by the leaders from centuries well after 297. References to the kingdom of the Picts, Pictland, are pretty rare, but it seems from the life of St. Columba that the Maiatai are still around in the form of a district referred to as Manaw and the Maitai. And then in the 8th century, Bede talks at some length about the Picts. He'd obviously spoken to a reasonably authoritative Pictish source, and he describes a kingdom with a south and a north, separated by a highland ridge of the Grampians, probably the Munth. So in summary, what we have is the appearance of a nation which is seen as one people. All the references refer to the Picts in a way that assumes they are one people. But they also assume they are one people with some subdivisions within them. So, as in Caledonians and other Picts, for example, from that earlier quote. The divisions of Cruinia may be fiction, but they may well reflect later divisions that needed to be explained somehow in the 9th century. And yet this is not one people with a number of different divisions. By and large, it appears to be a nation with one king. So these are regions rather than kings, or less likely but possibly sub-kings. The point about all this, then, is that we have a kingdom of the Picts emerging, but need to be constantly aware that it's not a simple monolithic and homogeneous kingdom. It has distinct and recognisable subdivisions, and when we talk later about the society of the Picts, we'll make the point that in the 4th century, it was scarcely possible for a nation in northern Britain to maintain effective control and communication as a modern or even medieval state. We can assume a very large amount of local independence and local identity. There's something else going on here too as well. So, somehow the Caledonians and the Maiatai had become the Picts. Whoa, hang on, how did that happen? It's another nail in the coffin of Gildas's worms, actually. The Caledonians and the Maiatai survive into later centuries as names, so they weren't swept away by all these invading Picts then. But how can it be that the Caledonians have suddenly become Picts, as strongly implied by the sentence in that earlier quote, Caledonians and other Picts? The first thing to note is that the name, Picts, is probably not what the inhabitants of northern Britain called themselves at the time. It's what their enemies called them. In this case, the Romans. Most now seem to agree that the source of the name comes from the Latin picti, the painted ones. There's no other evidence, actually, that the northern Britons did paint their skin or have tattoos by the time the 3rd and 4th centuries had rolled around. It could be that it's just a nickname which reflects reality, i.e., those blokes over the wall that paint their skin all the time. Fine. But actually, it's more likely that it's a term of mild abuse or contempt. Elsewhere, the practice of body art had pretty much died out. It could well, by this time, have been seen as more than a little antiquated. Little did the Romans know that in a couple of millennia it would be back with a vengeance, so much so that international footballers would look like an exhibition at the local art gallery. But I'm going to pull out of this one before someone slaps a curmudgeon sticker on my forehead. Or, warning, old and crusty, approach with caution. We don't want that, do we? No, I was saying that body art had become out of date. And so Picti, as a term, in 297 was probably a mild insult. So why did the term appear in 297? Why not before? And actually, a rather trivial fact seems to hide some seismic changes which will not end well for Rome, and indeed Roman Britain. By the late 3rd century, the system and agreements established by Severus in 208 seems to have broken down. Up to the middle of the 3rd century, the pattern we spoke of last time was pretty consistent. Between the walls, Outer Brigantia is characterised by flag-waving Romanizers like the Wotidini in Lothian. They might not be within Hadrian's Wall, but they loved the Roman way of life nonetheless. And they hung out the flags when they passed, invited each other to parties and all that. Further out in Illa Caledonia, the area around the Antonine Wall, the Clyde Forth Line, the contact was less, but still consistent, still friendly, or at least active. But from 250, there seems to have been a very significant change. This contact in Illa Caledonia seems to have stopped. The temperature dropped. Roman-Caledonian relationships were distinctly frosty. It's worth noting that there isn't any more violence, but nonetheless, no one is taking anyone flowers anymore. It could be that it was in Inner and Outer Caledonia that attitudes were hardening. Don't talk over the fence of that nasty Roman man, sort of thing. We love freedom and independence. Throw off the Roman sandal. But this would seem strange, given that actually for decades now the system has worked very well. Roman subsidies and elite goods have oiled the wheels of Caledonian societies. After all, the Romans were far too busy to pose a threat to the independence of Outer Caledonia. They showed no sign of invading in the 3rd century. So why would Outer Caledonia start a war? No, what's more likely is that Roman policy changed, that the availability of nice fat subsidies for the far north had dried up, and that from necessity, resources needed elsewhere in the empire could no longer be devoted to keeping the Caledonians and Maiatai sweet. And so attitudes hardened. Contempt found its way into the language. Caledonians became Picti. So that's bad. After all, we'd rather have love and kisses, exchanging precious gifts and taking each other flowers than glaring at each other over the Ley Landi, would we not? What made this especially dangerous, however, was that it was accompanied by changes in the social makeup of the peoples of Caledonia going on at the same time. It is a change that has parallel in other European societies, Franks and Saxons, for example. Within the farmer republics we spoke of were the informal elites, like gangsters, the folks who are able to get themselves nice things, normally nice Roman things, and therefore listen to history podcasts and stand out from the crowd by so doing. Now, those informal elites were becoming much more formal, much more structured. With their nice things, their material success, they were becoming capable of binding the less successful to them with structured relationships, like, you know, lord and subordinate. Of course, if you were going to be a boss, you needed to be able to act big as well as talk big. Otherwise, at some point, someone somewhere is going to call you on it. So the new leaders gathered around them blokes with big muscles, warriors, whose job it was to fight. Warriors were very different from the farmers who would one day put the plough in the shed, dig out whatever weapon they could find from behind the sofa along with a bit of lint, and head out to join Calgarcus to try and face down Agricola's legions. These were instead professional warriors. They didn't farm at all. Their new lord arranged for them to be fed and housed by using the tributes they collected from their underlings and farmers. It's beginning to sound much more medieval. In the life of St. Columba, the family unit was described. Although given that the life was written in the 7th century, about the 6th century, admittedly it is some time after the period we're discussing at the moment. But the author, Ad Manan, describes a nuclear family, the familia, and then with hangers-on around it, the familiares. And part of those familiares were the cohors, the lords' armed retinue. Not far behind warlords and cohors, of course, would finally come kings. So what, I hear you say. I mean, shame to see the end of farmer republics, they sounded nice in theory. Well, except for the constant violence, cattle rustling, and lack of an effective equitable justice system, but hey, never mind. We all know lords would appear at some point. You can't keep the buffety class down forever. Well, what this meant for Rome was this. Just at the point they were no longer managing their relationships with the Caledonians and the Maiatai, let alone the people of Atlantic Scotland, these very people were developing a much greater capability for organised war and violence. The capability, in short, to take the war to Rome. In 305, then, the Emperor Constantius Chlorus, father of Constantine the Great, appeared in northern Britain and launched a campaign against the Picts. The Severan system had comprehensively broken down by this stage. Relationships were back to the old adversarial days of Agricola. The aggressive Roman Empire versus native, eager not to recede a gladius in the guts, deeply resentful about being imposed on, and with no desire to be conquered. Some of the Picts, no doubt, were scared at the Roman legions. Some of them, equally doubtlessly, wanted revenge for the violence Constantius inflicted on them, and all they'd wanted were a few handouts and some nice tableware. Rome would pay a heavy price for its change of policy and for its violence of 305. By the 340s, Roman Britannia's defences were a shadow of their former glory. The flexible legionary that used to occupy Hadrian's Wall had been replaced for the main part by much more limited garrison troops. As the Empire struggled to fight off barbarian invasions all over its frontiers, it preferred to maintain legions centrally, rushing then to put out the fires by focusing superior numbers where they were needed, while garrison troops tried to hold the line until they arrived. In this more defensive strategy, the Count of the Saxon Shore, a man called Nectaridus, was responsible for the south and southeast of Britannia, to defend Britannia against continental invaders, while the Dux Britannia, a man called Fulofaudes, was responsible for the north. The strategy, to a degree, depended on an unsophisticated opposition, and one which the defensive garrison troops could at least temporarily hold up or slow down. The events of the 4th century then were recorded by Ammianus Marcellinus. In 360, he recorded this. But in Britain, during Constantius's 10th and Julian's 3rd year of consulship, the wild tribes of the Scots and the Picts broke their undertaking to keep peace, were causing destruction in those areas near the frontiers. Now, on this occasion, a man called Lupicinius seems to have re-established order, though there are a few specifics about how. But then, in 367, events of an entirely different magnitude hit the empire. Here is our correspondent again. During this period, practically the whole Roman world heard the trumpet call of war, as savage peoples stirred themselves and raided the frontiers nearest to them. The Alemanni were ravaging Gaul and Rhaetia simultaneously. The Sarmatians and Cadi were devastating Pannonia. The Picti, Saxoners, Scoti and Attacotti were bringing continual misery upon Britain. The Ostoriani and other Moorish peoples were attacking Africa with more than usual violence. The predatory bands of Goths were plundering Thrace and Moesia. Ammianus went on. Valentinian was shocked to receive the serious news that a concerted attack by the barbarians had reduced the province of Britannia to the verge of ruin. Nectaridus, the count of the coastal region, had been killed, and the general Fulafaudes surprised and cut off. It will suffice to say that at that time the Picts, the Dicaledones and Verturiones, together with the warlike Atticotti and the Scotti, were roving at large and causing great devastation. This then is what becomes known as the Barbarian Conspiracy. It's not possible to be absolutely clear that the waves of barbarians that crashed over the borders of the empire was in fact a coordinated attack, but it looks awfully like it. The invasions in Britain by Picti, Scotti, Saxons and Atticotti were a result of that change in policy over a century before, which had led to a rising tide of violence just as nations like the Picts were acquiring much greater ability to significantly damage the Romans. The count of the Saxon shore, we assume, was killed by the Saxons, but Fulafaudes presumably was a victim of the Picts or the Scots. The extent of the chaos reflected the capability of professional warriors to overwhelm the Roman garrison troops, their superiority of numbers and training a thing of the past. It took 4 years for the Roman Empire to re-establish control after the barbarian conspiracy with the arrival of Theodosius with Roman legions. 4 years where Roman Britain would have been subjected to a level of chaos and violence for which they were completely unprepared, and with which they were completely unable to cope. It was the beginning of the end of the empire, and within 50 years, the Roman legions would be gone from Britannia forever. You will have noticed three groups from northern Britain. Our friends the Picti, the Scotti, and the Atticotti. No one has ever satisfactorily described the Atticotti, so sorry, we'll just have to leave them alone. Now the Scotti, that may make you prick up your ears. Aha! Here we are, the start of the name of Scotland. We can stop talking about northern Britain, which is irritating anyway. Well, no, not just yet. The Scotti referred to were in fact the Irish. And here is another derogatory nickname. The word means pirate. Of course, in the end, Scotty will, of course, lend itself to become Scotland, but not for a long time yet. We'll come back to get more thrust from Scotty at a future episode. Back to the Picti then. You'll notice that Ammianus described two types of Pict, the Dicaledones and the Verturiones. The former, of course, seemed to be a derivative of the Caledonians. The other, the Verturiones, we will place in the north of Scotland, north of the Munth, to become a leading Pictish kingdom. But we'll come back to that again. For the moment, we just need to register that again. Although the Picts are seen as one people, they are clearly a people divided in some way. And secondly, that once again their names and divisions are changing. Just to recap then. The Picts have been named for the first time in 297 by the Romans. It's not their name, it's given to them by their enemies. By the start of the 3rd century, and probably earlier, the Romans are indeed the enemies of the Picts, not their trading and diplomatic partners as they had been under the Severan system. The society of the peoples the Romans now called Picts had been changing, like many others, from farmer republic to petty kingdoms. By the 4th century, a combination of Roman diplomatic policy and failures, Pictish resentment and greater Pictish military capability resulted first in trouble in Inner Caledonia as the Picts raided the Rome-friendly tribes like the Wotidini in Outer Brigantia, resulting in Constantius's campaign in 305, only to be overwhelmed by the barbarian conspiracy in 367, which began the final destruction of the Western Empire. There remains one more topic for this week then. The changing of names is a bit bewildering. From Ptolemy's 10 northern tribes, to the Caledonians and the Maiatai, to now the Verturiones and the Dicaledones, who apparently act as part of a larger whole, seeing themselves as one people, the Picts. What's with all the name changing? What's going on? Who are they? Who am I? Where is my identity? Of course, Gildas's answer was the wiggly worm one, that all these Picts and indeed Scotty came out of the darkness from across the seas and replaced the people that had been there before. But there's no supporting archaeological evidence supporting this. The names of the old tribes remain within the name of the Picts. There's no genocidal invasion. So what is going on? At this point, I must introduce you to the word ethnogenesis. This is a satisfyingly pretentious word which you will not find on your spell checker, which makes me feel even more smug, actually. Of course, many of you will be well ahead of me, in which case, well, sorry, I'll try to be quick. We've talked a bit earlier about the confusion of DNA evidence and how it seems to point any number of ways. If it tells us anything, it most certainly tells us, if we didn't already know, that ethnicity is not purely defined by where you come from and your biological makeup. Human scientists define ethnicity much more broadly as, quote, identification with a broader group in opposition to others on the basis of perceived cultural differentiation and or common descent. Fair enough. So how is it then that groups begin to identify themselves and become nations? Well, there are broadly two theories, apparently. Some argue that it's all about what you're born with. Territory. I'm born in Loughborough, therefore I am Loughborian. Religion, language, culture. I support the Leicester Tigers, and therefore I am Loughborian. Others say, no, it's all much more flexible than this. It's driven by politics and economics. I want to be Roman because they have nice tableware. I've always fancied being an emperor, so I might live in Traparain-law, but I'm going to become Roman, please. A chap called Richard Wenscus took all this and developed a theory about how it might apply to the formation of nations in the first 1000 years AD. He noted that nations we think of as coherent nations, the Franks, the Goths, actually started as a hodgepodge of different tribal groups. Then they formed a confederation, took battle to the evil empire, won, and settled down. As they did so, they looked to a core elite group to help them build a story, an apparently authentic tradition of who they were, why they belonged together, where they came from. And before you know it, the genesis of these traditions are lost in the mist of time and accepted by everyone as truth. Now, the theory is not without its critics, and I suspect that's putting it mildly. But it kind of fits our situation, doesn't it? Hodgepodge of tribes, check. Ptolemy and his 10 tribes of the north. A shared story, check. Truenia and his 7 sons. I'm sure there's a drinking song like that. Maybe it's Abraham. Father Abraham had 7 sons. Happy days. Just like the Franks and the Goths, these tribes formed a confederation and attacked their enemy in pursuit of revenge for past violence and in pursuit of riches. Check. So, as the barbarian conspiracy led to further chaos and opportunity for the northern tribes, at some point, no one quite knew when, these tribes decided that the insulting nickname their enemies had given them, the Picti, was a perfectly reasonable one to take up. It had a clear resonance with their shared aim to rip the Romans to shreds. They had plenty of shared heritage and a shared language already, so it wasn't difficult. They had a single king, but that was no great imposition. We have to recognise that any kind of lordship or central authority was very light indeed. So locally, you could pretty much get on with it. And so from an insult, sometime in the 3rd century, the idea of a Pictish nation was born. Sometime in the 4th and 5th centuries, a Pictish nation became a reality. Great! How fun was that on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being super fun? Go and check out Pictish Beasts and Symbols on the website, they're a treat. Next time, we might as well hear a bit more about the Scotty, if we can tear him away from his dilithium crystals, and Christianity. And of course, more about the Picts to boot. Have fun, live long, and prosper, and I promise I will stop cracking inane jokes about the Scotty and Star Trek. Seriously, promise.